Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
In this month's Fire Marshal's Corner, we start with some very sound advice from South Carolina Fire Marshal John Reich about holiday fire safety, particularly when it comes to Christmas tree fires. Every year, these fires happen, but they are very easily preventable with some simple steps. NIST has a great video on how fast a Christmas tree ignites that can be downloaded and used in your public safety programs. Following that, we talk with Mike Love, Fire Marshal for Montgomery County, about the great electronic groups that he has created for fire prevention professionals to exchange information. One is called eParade and focuses on fire marshals, and the other one, the National Fire and Life Safety Educators Group, focuses on educational issues for fire safety educators. Finally, we have an interview that was done for our companion podcast, Campus Fire Watch Radio, with Gail Minger. Gail headed up a governor's task force to look at fire safety in Kentucky's colleges and universities, and the task force conducted focus groups across the state, and published an outstanding report looking at these issues. On a follow-up in an earlier podcast, we had interviewed Phil Shaneman about the study that he had done in the United Kingdom and Scandinavia looking at fire prevention practices. At the time, the report hadn't been published, but it's now available, and you can click on the page here and download that report to take a look at it. So with that, let's get into this month's show of Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Camo. Okay, joining us today on Fire Marshal's Corner here on Radio at Firehouse.com is John Reich, who's the fire marshal from South Carolina. Thanks for joining us, John.
Good morning, Ed. Thank you for having me.
We're going to take this opportunity to talk to John about Christmas tree fire safety as we're moving into the holiday season. And it's fires that we see every year, just time and again, and there are quite a few of them across the nation, aren't there, John?
There certainly are, and we want to concentrate our efforts on residential fire safety because 33 million households in the United States use, and that's one-third of the population, use cut Christmas trees or artificial trees during the decorative season.
And what's some of the problems that we see with these? I mean, it's obviously a right way and a wrong way to be using these, and what are some of the problems that we see arising?
Well, certainly. The first thing, we want to educate people of the hazards of trees, and it's like anything else, if used properly, it would be safe. Last year, we had 210 reported fires by Christmas trees in the United States, resulting in 24 civilian deaths and 27 injuries, resulting in approximately $14 million worth of damage.
Wow, that's an incredible amount of damage from such a relatively low number of fires. I mean, so obviously they're pretty catastrophic when they do break out.
They are catastrophic, Ed, and when you review these statistics, one out of every nine Christmas tree fires results in a fire fatality.
Oh, wow. And a terrible time of year, too, for this to be happening.
Certainly.
What causes these fires? I mean, what's the ignition source, and what contributes to such a catastrophic fire?
It's a good question, Ed. 48% of the fires on Christmas trees are caused by some type of an electrical failure. When we look at those statistics closer, it broke down to approximately 22% of the Christmas tree fires, out of that 48% on the electrical origin, are because of the lights themselves. People do not use the cool lamp lights. They use a little larger lights, the little hotter lights, which shouldn't be used on those Christmas trees. They use them year after year after year. They store them in the attic, or they store them in a closed container, and the wires have a tendency to dry rot, break, become brittle, the bulbs are cracked, they will become loose, which actually causes an arc and starts the tree on fire.
And when these trees burn, they burn pretty good, don't they?
They certainly do. We have some videotapes by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and flashover in the room was under 4 minutes once a tree is ignited. So that's why it's important to, when you use your Christmas tree, to buy, and I'll go through some of these safety tips in just a bit. One other thing I want to add is statistical data, though. 27% are because of heat sources, open candles of fireplaces. So after you purchase your tree, locate it properly. Keep it out of the way of the exits so it doesn't obstruct your exit, and keep it away from heat sources.
And that video that you mentioned, we'll have a link to it here on the page down below where people can see it. And it is pretty impressive how fast, once it ignites, how fast it just takes right off and fully involves the room. It's pretty riveting, and I think anybody who's seen it is just certainly going to be aware of the dangers of fire safety.
The first thing we want to cover is the purchase of the Christmas tree. In South Carolina, we're a rural state with less than 5 million people in it, and we're fortunate to have choose and cut usually family-owned Christmas tree farms within a reasonable distance to your home, where you could actually go into the field and cut your Christmas tree. Certainly, when you cut a Christmas tree, you know it's as fresh as it could be. But in metropolitan areas and, you know, in southern areas that don't have the Christmas tree types, people go out and purchase these. And some of these Christmas trees have been cut weeks and weeks prior to the Christmas season. So make sure that when you purchase a tree that has been cut recently, and shake it, make sure that the needles do not fall off, and then recut the bottom of the Christmas tree. Take at least 1/2 inch off of the bottom of the tree, and we recommend people to cut it on a 45-degree angle. So this way, when you put it in the tub of water, the Christmas tree stand, a sturdy stand so it doesn't tip over, that it will absorb this water. And it's amazing how many gallons of water that you could put in a Christmas tree over just a week or two. So make sure that, check it every day, make sure that that water is filled up.
I mean, I do a fresh cut tree myself, and I'm really amazed, just like you said, how much water it sucks up in such a short period of time. It is something you really do need to stay on top of to watch, to make sure that you are watering it properly. Now, you see these on the market a lot, these additives that can be put in there to really add to the length of the life of the tree. Do they really do anything, or is just simple water is the best way to go?
I don't believe they work. Some people swear by it, but I'm going to go back to the model codes, the consensus codes. Mm-hmm. Years ago, we used to let people put in an additive or actually spray the Christmas tree with a flame retardant on it for mm-hmm. commercial occupancies. That has been removed from the codes in the I codes that we use in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And actually, Christmas trees are prohibited in many types of commercial occupancies, including assemblies, educational school buildings, residential hotels, motels, and apartments. Institutional occupancies, departments of corrections, and nursing homes and hospitals, unless there is an exception where the building is completely sprinkled. Mm-hmm. And then it allows it in some of the areas, but not all the areas.
How about artificial trees? Are there a problem with those?
There is a problem with those, and with this data that I gave out earlier, as far as the fires, they include artificial Christmas trees because some artificial Christmas trees are not flame retardant. It's important when you purchase that Christmas tree, if you're going to get an artificial type, to ensure that it has a flame retardant label on it.
And when you're picking out your lights, too, I suppose one of the things to look for is see if it's UL listed or third-party listed to make
Absolutely.
Sure they do
make
meet
sure
the standards.
Absolutely. Make sure it's third-party listed or UL laboratory approved, mm-hmm. and they're the cool type. If you wrap your hand around it and you don't feel any heat being generated off in the palm of your hand, mm-hmm. that's the type of lamps. The larger bulbs, if you can't hold them in your hand, you certainly don't want them on your Christmas tree.
Right.
We also recommend to keep them out of the direct sunlight. A lot of times people put a Christmas tree on the east or the west side of the house in the sun, and it has a tendency to actually dry the tree out much, much faster.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've recently been in a home where I've seen a Christmas tree that was placed right in front of a heat register, and the heat constantly blowing on that has a tendency to dry the tree out much, much faster.
Well, worst case scenario, somebody has their tree catches on fire. What should they do?
Well, because of the intensity of the heat and flame propagation of the fire, do not attempt to extinguish it. Get out of the house. All your personal belongings could be replaced, but your lives cannot be.
Right.
So if you do have a fire, get out of the house. And of course, during the holiday season, we encourage people. And I know we just did a time change, and everyone went and checked their smoke alarms to make sure that the batteries and the detectors were operable. But a lot of times, people do not have them in every room the house has designed in the new code. Make sure you have smoke alarms in every room in the house. Make sure they're operable. Make sure that you have a safety plan. So when your alarm goes off, you only have a matter of a couple seconds or a minute to get out of that house. Make sure you close the door, get out of the house. If you can't get through the house, use your secondary means of exit by closing that door and using your window to get out. Buy a little time that way. We also recommend that people consider residential sprinkler for maximum protection. Smoke alarms and residential sprinklers combine to 82% of the survival rate. So if you have a fire and if you have a sprinkler and smoke alarms in your home, the chances are 82% that you will survive that fire along with your family and get out.
You had mentioned earlier, too, candles. I mean, we see a rise in candles about this time of year, too. a number of fires contributing to that, not only setting a Christmas tree on fire, but just other things in general. What are some of the things people should do when they're using candles?
Well, we prefer that people use candles only, just like Christmas tree lights, only use them when you're in the room itself, so you could monitor this. When you leave the room or you leave the house, make sure that they are extinguished properly. Many people don't extinguish candles properly. They just go up to them and they blow them out. They do not snuff them out, where the little ember will drop into the decorative materials adjoining this. Or they don't have a glass globe around it, where it actually tips over and falls over or burns down and then sets the decorations on fire. When you use candles, just like smokers, make sure that you move the lighters and the matches away from the hands of little children. Children are curious, and with all the Christmas wrappings and decorative materials around, it only takes a second for a major fire.
Well, hopefully with some of these tips, you know, the people out there listening can use them in their own communities to try to spread the word, so we don't see the fatalities again this year from candles and Christmas trees and all the other things we see this time of year, which just ruins a wonderful holiday season. I mean, ruins anybody's life anytime, but even more so this time of year during the holidays. They're so tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, joining us today on Fire Marshal's Corner has been Fire Marshal John Reich from the South Carolina Fire Marshal's Office. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us today, John.
Thank you for having me, Ed, and have a safe holiday season.
Well, you too, and we're going to have a lot more information on the website here if you look below. So thanks for joining us today on Radio at Firehouse.com.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And joining us today on Fire Marshal's Corner is Division Chief Mike Love with the Montgomery County Fire Department. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Glad to be here.
Ask Mike to join us because he is kind of the leader and the person behind a great communications tool that a number of us have been using called eParade, which is an email listserv. And maybe you can explain a little bit about what that's all about, Mike.
Yes, I certainly would like to provide some information here. In 2003, U.S. Fire Administration held a conference of all the state and metro-sized fire department fire marshals. We got together at the U.S. Fire Academy in November of that year, and we had a great sharing opportunity, and this was the first time this had ever been conducted. And one of the things that we had talked about was that, you know, we would certainly like to have this kind of thing on a day-to-day basis, but we weren't sure exactly how to go about doing that. The trade organization, which is for training organizations throughout the country through U.S. Fire Administration, had been doing a one-way bulletin board where they would send in people throughout the country would send in the information and they would get it posted once a week by U.S. Fire Administration. And you could subscribe to that as an email. We thought that was good, but it wasn't exactly what we thought was appropriate for us. So I suggested that we have use of maybe one of the Yahoo or Google type email listservs, which I had already had an opportunity to use in other settings. In particular, Emergency Medical Services had a quality assurance website and a Yahoo group that they had up and running back in the 90s, and I was a part of that when I was running our EMS division. And so I thought, man, this is a great opportunity to use this for fire marshals who had never been connected nationally. So that's basically the premise behind it, and from there it's history. We just started putting this thing together, and people joined over a period of this time.
About how many members do you have now?
Last time I checked, we had 353 members. Interestingly, when we had our parade conference back in April, there were only 250 members. So it's steadily growing all the time.
You know, and it's a great tool. I mean, I'm on there, and just, you know, the constant flow of information each day. Do you have any idea how many messages are going across there each day?
I think really probably the highest that I've seen was about, I don't know, about 40 messages in a day, which is that's pretty busy. We generally average around 100 a month, 100 a week, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. And can you give us some examples of some of the information that's going back and forth and the questions that are being posed and answered?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it runs the whole gamut of anything that a fire marshal or other life safety professional would be able to find useful. But an example, everybody started noticing these burglar alarm systems in their areas that when the burglar alarm was tripped, it would send a cloud of that typical theatrical smoke that completely obscured the air so you couldn't see. And, of course, everybody was concerned by the fact that this would possibly trigger a fire call when somebody saw smoke in this occupancy, and then firefighters go out and respond and potentially be in a wreck or something like that, or get in the store and not know where the bad guy is and get harmed by the criminal that broke in there. So we shared this information among us, and it spread across the United States basically through our network, which, by the way, goes Alaska and Hawaii and everything to the East Coast down to Florida. So almost every state is involved. And so word gets out like that. And then another one was a big-time use of this was for fire department access widths and roads, and everybody compared notes about some of their dealings with their planning agencies and the troubles they were having with the intent on shrinking the size of roads and making more compact developments. And then any given day it can be discussion of success rates of fire sprinklers and talking about a new problem that's popped up. And then you'll also get people on there who are very new to the industry and really have an overwhelming sense of where to go with their new job, and so they'll call in for advice and how do I get started, what books are important for me to have, and what are the training requirements and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's just huge range of uses,
and it's the sort of thing too where people are bringing up problems that they probably think are unique to their jurisdiction, but they're realizing that no, somebody else has faced it and addressed it and may have the answer for them out there.
Absolutely, and that's that was actually the very seed of why we needed it, so people could share information. And of course that's what that whole parade organization was all about, was sharing of data and resources.
Mm-hmm. Now, the big question I'm sure people listening to this are going to have is, how do I get on eParade? What's the process for people getting on?
Well, there's a number of ways you can go, and the one that we would like to see people go to, and this is certainly not a commercial, but you go to Yahoo, and it's, really just go to www.yahoo.com, which is certainly very well familiar with everyone. And then there's a hyperlink on their menu on the far left-hand side, and it says Groups about a third of the way down, Groups, G-R-O-U-P-S. Click on that, and then that'll take you to a registration site for Yahoo Groups. And then you, the preferred way would be for you to then sign up for Yahoo, and then search through their many hundreds of thousands of groups that they have for eParade. The other way that they can do it is just directly email me at michael.love@montgomerycountymd.gov, and I'll sign them up.
Okay. Now, you've kind of expanded this into other areas as well, haven't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the... and actually I was involved in this even before I got involved with eParade, but right now we have, I guess, five very active electronic email groups, including one that we started as an offshoot for eParade, which is for fire and life safety educators, and that's called National Fire and Life Safety Educators, or NFLSE. And then recently we started one, since another area of my division in the fire department is recruiting, we started one that's brand new called Fire Department Recruiting and Diversity. And the intent there, of course, is to get recruiting officers together throughout the country and help them, because they have similar problems that the fire marshals have, and a grouped and well-connected network certainly helps everybody. Mm-hmm. We also have one in the National Capital Region, Washington, D.C., for our incident management team. We have a Type 2 UASI started incident management team, and so we use that for coordination, and that's worked out very well.
Right. I think, it's just the ability to communicate so quickly, too. It's amazing how quickly the answers come. You know, it's, you can tell that people are just sitting there monitoring this on a regular basis, because once somebody poses a question or a problem, the answers just come flying right across so quickly.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. And actually, I don't think I could have been more pleased with the way the e-parade started. And it took about a year to really get going well, and it's just taken off. And I'm at conferences or something, and somebody will come up to me that I don't even know, never met, and they say, "Oh, I'm so-and-so. I'm on the group." And I recognize their name, and, of course, you know, instantly you have a much higher level of relationship with somebody than if you met them cold. So right. It certainly does fit that networking potential.
Right. Well, you know, Mike has really created, and pretty much on his own initiative here, a series of groups on Yahoo that really allow for some great information exchange among fire safety professionals across the nation. And, you know, really appreciate you taking the effort to go forward and do this, Mike, because it is just an absolutely incredibly powerful tool. I know that I'm on it. I'm one of those people watching it pretty regularly, and the amount of traffic on there and the complexity of the problems, too, show that, you know, it is a great tool for everybody to use.
Well, thank you, and certainly it was kind of a selfish reason to help get it started, because I needed the help as much as anybody did. So, so I probably benefited more than anybody. Right. But we also, just to mention, we also have members in India as well as Dubai. So It's kind of spreading out across the world.
All right. Well, we've been talking to Division Chief Mike Love with Montgomery County Fire Department, who has been the leader in starting up several listservs. The most notable one is E-Parade, which really allows for a great exchange of information among fire safety professionals across the country and spreading out, as he just said, around the world. And we appreciate you taking the time to join us, Mike.
Thank you, Ed. Appreciate that.
Okay. And you're listening to Fire Marshal's Corner on radio at firehouse.com.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And this is Ed Camo here on Campus Firewatch Radio on radio at firehouse.com. And joining us this morning is Gail Minger, who's the chair of the Governor's Task Force for Campus Safety in Kentucky. Thanks for joining us, Gail.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm not sure if I could, actually, did I get the task force name right, Gail?
Yes, you did.
Oh, okay, great. Gail Minger has been an advocate in campus fire safety for a number of years, and she came through this through an unfortunate tragedy, terrible tragedy, where her son Michael was killed in a fire at Murray State University. And since that time, she has just become such a strong voice and such an advocate for campus fire safety that the governor tapped her to head up this task force, which is kind of interesting given that Gail doesn't even live in Kentucky. She lives in Florida. So maybe you can fill us in a little bit, Gail, on how this task force came to be and who makes it up and where you're going with it.
Certainly. Several years ago, back in 2004, actually, I had written a proposal and given it to the governor's office. It was a new administration at that time. But I had seen, since Michael's death, year in and year out, some compliance issues, and I was very concerned about it. And then also how a crime or instances were investigated once a terrible incident had happened on campus. It seemed like there were many jurisdictional problems, which is historical, but that they were not working together. They were basically working against one another. And with those two ideas, the compliance issue and the working together after a terrible incident had happened, is really what got me thinking, we need to really take a good look at this. So I went to the governor with this proposal, and then this past last winter, actually, he did go ahead and write an executive order and formed the task force, the governor's task force on campus safety, and we met for the first time in mid-January of 2007. And we came together to look at these problems as well as many others. He really gave us a very, very comprehensive list. He wanted us to basically conduct comprehensive examination, evaluation of all campus safety, the adequacy of the campus safety and security standards, building and fire codes as they related to residential facilities and classroom buildings, policies and procedures with respect to fire, safety, crimes, law enforcement investigations, and just on and on. Also looking at existing legislation, regulation, policies, and practices. And it was just a huge undertaking, and we had 6 months to get it done. And we met with lots of experts in the area. We visited campuses, held forums, which unfortunately weren't very well attended, actually. Some campuses were and others weren't. There were many reasons for that. Some of them we hit during spring break. But generally, for the number of students that attend post-secondary institutions in the state, the turnout wasn't that great. And some would say, well, that's because they're not worried about safety. Well, if you talk to them on campus, which I made, along with others, many campus visits, and we would have housing people, fire people, campus police administrators go along with us. I was never just roaming a campus by myself. And they were very welcoming. And for the most part, they wanted to, they were very proud, of course, at first, to point out the things that they felt they were doing really well. And then also, most of them were very glad to say these are the things that we really need some help with or are taking a look at because we don't feel that we're doing them as well as we could be doing. So that was, I was happy to see that attitude. Some schools don't have that attitude. They basically think they're doing everything right and don't really want to hear what you have to say, but it's come to the attention with the amount of crime. The statistics are just mind-boggling with over 97,000, and that's reported assaults on campuses each year, sexual assaults, suicides.
Is that nationwide or just for Kentucky?
Yes, nationwide, and okay. Suicides and so forth. And the nationwide, it's 1 in 4 young women, but in Kentucky, they did their own through a wonderful grant. They have a woman at the University of Kentucky, Dorothy Edwards, and Sharon LaRue at the University of Louisville who have done extensive work in this area, and they have found that it's the national average is 1 in 4. In Kentucky, it's 1 in 3. Mm. So it's a huge problem. And then the underlying problem for lots of violence, setting of fires and other things, violence and crime on campus is drugs and alcohol as well. So this was a massive undertaking. As I said, we were charged to look at all of those areas as well as how they store biological, nuclear and chemical waste on some of the campuses that actually deal with that. So we had our work cut out for us, and some things we could just answer briefly at this point because they really will need more investigation. But so that's what we were charged to do.
Who were some of the people that were on the task force with you that made it up?
Sure. We had the Deputy Secretary, of the Justice Cabinet here in Kentucky. We had a gentleman, a Director of Center for Campus Safety, K-12, and some of the university's chief of police, some of their fire people, directors of safety and security on several of the campuses. We had the State Fire Marshal, the Assistant State Fire Marshal, gentleman from the Council on Post-Secondary Education, and also the president of the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities, as well as a gentleman that sat in all the time. He wasn't commissioned to the task force, but he heads up, the Kentucky Center for Technical and Community Colleges. So we were very well covered with everyone involved. And it was tough in the beginning because as a parent advocate and someone that is interested in the safety and well-being of all students, some people in the beginning were they took it very personal for their campus. But I think they got the big picture and started looking at it as a statewide and then actually as a national problem. And so, therefore, it worked out quite well. So.
Now, you mentioned that you went across the state holding sessions at specific schools.
Yes.
There's some. Can you give us some specific examples of what you learned at these things, maybe some of the findings that or what people were saying to you at
sure,
some of these schools?
Sure. Well, one of the major things, I think the number one thing, it was consistent at every campus, was the it was bothersome to students that people got into their dormitories that didn't belong in them. I mean, they really have worked hard, the universities, with key entrances, key slide entrances, really trying to monitor the situation, making sure doors are all locked, putting some schools have alarms on those doors. Some schools don't have the ability to man a front desk. They don't have the funds even to pay a student worker, that kind of thing, some of the very small schools. But it's still, no matter, it seemed even the schools that had a lot of great things in place, that still was a problem. It's kids piggyback one another in. They're not paying attention. On the smaller campuses, they seem to know more who belongs and who doesn't. But on the larger campuses, oftentimes it was just kids being polite. They'd hold the door for someone else, and it could be someone that absolutely should not be in that dormitory. But I heard that over and over. Everywhere we went, we heard it from more than just a few students. It was resounding. Hmm. The next thing was we did ask them about fire, if they knew how to get out and that kind of thing. And most of them said, we do have fire drills, but we don't take them that seriously. I wasn't very pleased that schools will take a lot of them. Again, I can't say everyone, but would take 70% of evacuation and call that a good fire drill. What about the other 30% of the kids that didn't have the opportunity to participate for whatever reason? They were off campus, they were in class. You know, there are multiple reasons, but that was a little bothersome to me. But that was one thing. They said they really didn't have great fire training, training in responding to fires, and also the evacuation. The schools all have evacuation plans. We found this out after the Virginia Tech situation. The governor called another group together, his steering committee, and they were to look very, very closely at all of the evacuation plans and found that all the schools have them. Again, there may be one or two exceptions from a very small school, but they all had them in place but weren't implementing or practicing them. So people that were to respond and be part of the whole procedure didn't know what they were to do because they hadn't practiced them. They're there sitting on a shelf, so that's a recommendation that will be coming down to implement practice, have tabletop exercises, and that kind of thing to look at different scenarios. It's not, they have the idea, but they just aren't implementing the ideas and the work that they have put into writing these evacuation plans and so forth. So that was one thing. Also, kids are, you know, lighting in parking lots, having enough security guards. If they needed escorting, they would have to wait oftentimes. So, just dealing with being new students on campus and returning for, sophomores also, there's a lot for these kids to have to worry about. And my personal opinion is they absolutely should not have to worry about the things we've just discussed, that things should be in place for them. Of course, they have a significant responsibility as well to act responsibly. But these programs, they're really saying out loud, we want your help. You know, we want to be protected. We want to have these things in place. We don't think it's outside the realm of just really helping to protect us. So they are willing, and it's just, it comes down again to that old education, and telling them over and over and over, you can never say it too much.
What did you find about the physical fire protection in place at the schools? You know, I'm talking about things like fire alarms, sprinkler systems, the design of the buildings. Did you find anything on that?
Yes. The design of the buildings, I was flabbergasted at some things where even where sprinklers would be, the sprinkler heads would be painted. I didn't know technologically much, but we had inspectors that did know everything that needed to be known that went with us and showed us some areas where sprinkler heads were behind lighting fixtures, so they were actually in place, and the schools could say, yes, we have sprinklers. But unfortunately, where the sprinklers heads were put, they wouldn't be very helpful in helping to put out a fire because they were blocked. And other times, for example, one school, it was a wide-open common area, and it was well-sprinklered, but they came in and put in a partial wall around the Coke and vending machines to keep the noise down so the kids didn't hear all that, you know, noise coming out of those machines, and it blocked all the sprinklers' heads. So therefore, sitting in that room, they were not protected any longer. So those kinds of things with the designs, I was just flabbergasted that those kind of things exist. And some of the buildings are older. I'm not sure how often they test them. They are supposed to be inspected, but and this, you know, I don't want this to sound. This is not just Kentucky. This is everywhere. This is just. I've been to other states, and we have seen some of the same things. Not quite to the extent that I've seen here, but that's because this was our job to look at all of these areas of safety and compliance. All the state universities, the public universities in Kentucky, since Michael's death, were mandated by the former administration to have sprinklers, and indeed they do have them. Again, some of the problems that I just mentioned, do exist still. So we're in our recommendations addressing that as well. The off-campus. Of course, facilities, that's a big problem with kids. We visited some apartment complexes that are really, to me, on the campus proper, but they're not campus buildings. Well, actually, the campus had bought them up, and they're homes, and they made them into apartments, and kids had Christmas tree lights hung all around, and there were no sprinklers in those buildings, and so they were oftentimes, Ed, it's just not knowing. You know, it's like, oh my goodness. One young lady had a beautiful room, these pieces of material kind of draped from the ceiling, and she had Christmas tree lights all woven in among that material. And she was on, the 8th floor of a high-rise dorm, and she didn't understand that the sprinkler heads, there was nothing that they were so disturbed or just there was so much material and so forth in their way that they could have not done their job. They were obstructed. Mm-hmm. And maybe the material could have filled up with water and then just slammed down to the floor, but it was amazing. But she just didn't know. But then where are the people that are supposed to be monitoring that kind of thing in these areas? So it's, again, people had a good attitude. It was just a matter of not knowing. And you know, things can happen quite quickly. Kids can take batteries out of their smoke detectors. We're really working to, again, put in place things that will hopefully help that. But students, as I said earlier, have got to be part of the equation here as far as being responsible for their own safety and well-being.
Now, has the governor given any indication what he hopes to come out the other end? You're going to publish your report, and then what?
Well, this is an election year here, and our report is due to the governor on September the 7th, and we have quite a number of recommendations as he's asked for. And then I think the major thing is to have for him to mandate that these schools really also take a comprehensive look at their vulnerabilities and put a plan in place to address them. Some are easily fixed, others it will take a plan and some time. And I think, you know, the nation had a summit on campus safety, and we found so many of the very same things. It was amazing. After I read that, after we had gotten to work and had a lot of things down as to what was needed, and they're so similar. And the other thing is putting in place a center for a statewide center for campus safety that's a clearinghouse for information that can help assist, help with the compliance issues. And really, the one thing I will say from going around the state and holding these forums statewide, that when people came together from the smaller universities with some of the larger ones and sharing information in an atmosphere that was conducive and not pointing fingers type of atmosphere, it was, they were really enjoyed it and spoke out and said, we would really like to do this more often, because it's like big brother and little brother helping one another, sharing that information. So I think this Center for Campus Safety, a statewide center, would be so instrumental in helping to have that information available, compile it in a central location, and work from there to continue the work that the task force has started in addressing these problems and going forward with it.
Well, it sounds like you've done an incredible project down there, especially in such a short period of time, too.
Yes, it's been unbelievable. But the one thing, Ed, is I think the most important is that we're making people aware. You kind of put the light on this. People know that it exists, but it doesn't get much until there's a terrible tragedy. It's not marketed very well. Safety on campuses is not marketed at all, or not very well. And I think working to put it up as one of the top priorities, along with the programs that the universities offer, along with how great their football and basketball teams are, you know, those kind of things, safety needs to be right up there. It's just not as it's just not thought about in the same way, and it doesn't, unfortunately, bring kids to the campuses. But that's our job to, I believe, help change parents and students' mindset in saying, adding that to their list when they are looking for colleges, to check that off. Am I going to be able to be sleeping in a sprinkler building? Is this university have safety and security as a priority? And yes, that's one thing I'm going to check off as a need or a desire to go to this particular university.
And both Gail and I have had a chance to meet and work with a group of parents who have all, like Gail, lost children. And so often don't we hear the same sort of thing out of them? It's just something they just didn't think of. And they really didn't have a reason not to, they said. It's just something that wasn't on their radar screen.
Exactly. And even with my son Michael having a particular learning disability, it was on my radar screen. But unfortunately, I made a deadly assumption that because I understood some of these things to be the law, that I didn't realize they would be grandfathered in. And it was, again, a deadly assumption. And parents, we just believe that these institutions are going to certainly, of course, you're going to have everything in place for the safety and well-being of our child. But they have limited resources. They put their money where they decide, you know, is the best way to spend it. And in some cases, not all, some universities in this state, I must say the University of Louisville is a great standard or model to look at. They have a lot of best practices that it's every time, you know, we would have an issue and they would share what they do, it was very well thought out. And some of that is because of their location. You know, they had to be on their toes, and they've done an excellent job. And it would be good for other schools across the state to take notice of the things that they do. And you know what I love about it, even besides that they have a good plan or good safety and security program, is their attitude. And that's three-fourths of it to me. Their attitude is, but we can always improve. We can always do better. And here they're, you know, doing very well. So, but parents do think that these universities have all this in place. And, of course, you know, it's just something we expect and assume is taken care of, and that's not the case, and that's something all parents need to know. They need to start looking for these things, asking questions, and you have a great list of questions, Ed, that I've used as well many times for parents that they need to ask questions.
Well, and we'll certainly put that on the webpage here. If you look below, you'll see a link to those questions that parents can ask that we have put together over the years in working with people like Gail, who's, you know, to try to put a checklist together. So just like Gail said, they can think about these things in addition to the athletics and the academics and all those sort of things. You know, they can put fire safety on their radar screen and hopefully avoid the kind of tragedy that Gail and other parents have had to go through over the years.
That's
well, we've been
exactly
talking
right.
with Gail Minger, who's the chair of the Governor's Task Force for Campus Safety in Kentucky, where she has been working since January on putting together a report on the level of not only fire safety, but campus safety in general in Kentucky. And Gail, really want to appreciate, thank you, really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. And I, again, I can't tell everyone how important this is to really ask the questions and put this on your radar screen. Make it a priority for all parents and students of college-aged children, and starting actually in high school when you're starting to visit these schools. You have a lot of wonderful choices out there. A lot of schools are really paying attention to this now since many tragedies have occurred. And to continue to do that, I certainly appreciate it. There are more than 15 million young people attending colleges and universities across the nation, and we have a job to do. And so I'm very appreciative that I've had the opportunity in the state of Kentucky through this governor's administration to work on this and, again, raise the awareness. That's very important. And thank you again, Ed. I appreciate the time.
Well, my pleasure. And you've been listening to Campus Firewatch Radio on radio@firehouse.com. My name is Ed Kamau.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.